Oh, snaps.
The world is finally waking up to the crap that's baked into and sprayed on kibble dog food. No longer can commercial pet food manufacturers fool us with pretty pictures and false promises. This is the raw dog food truth. The view and opinions expressed on this podcast are not intended to replace medical advice. Before starting any raw diet, do research, ask lots of questions, and consult your vet.
Well, hello, raw feeders. I'm Dee Dee Mercer Moffitt, CEO of Raw Dog Food and Company, where your pet's health is our business, and friends, don't let friends feed kibble. Well, you guys remember when I was talking about the lawsuit that has been filed regarding the whole DCM, your dog has dilated cardiomyopathy. Oh my gosh. So we got to get you on a prescription diet. You remember all that? And I read you off the points. Well, today we got the man, Dan Shuloff, who actually filed the lawsuit. And I want to talk to him about this because it's so interesting, Dan. One, that you had the cojones to file the lawsuit, right? Going up against the big pet food industry. So we want to talk about that. We want to talk about what you found out, how you found out that they were just pulling the wool over people's eyes. So first, let's talk about this. Why? How did this lawsuit come about?
Well, I think any fair summary of the timeline involved in the lawsuit has to start with when I first became aware of the DCM controversy. So this isn't when I became aware of DCM as a disease or when I became aware of the well-documented nutritional causes of DCM that have been a part of the veterinary nutritional scientific literature for decades now.
Yeah.
But it's the summer of 2018 when, kind of out of the blue, the United States Food and Drug Administration's Center for Veterinary Medicine issued an announcement that it is beginning an investigation into whether, the way it was often reported, is grain-free pet foods are causing dogs to develop DCM. It was a very out-of-the-blue, unexpected thing, in according to most everybody that I spoke to about it, and it was certainly a surprise to me. It's kind of got two main points. One is that carbohydrate is really bad for dogs. That's kind of a scientific thesis that's at the heart of it. And then the second is the reason that most people might not even agree with that initial proposition is that, to a large degree, the veterinary community has been kind of systematically misled about some really important scientific topics by folks who have a vested interest in what those vets believe about those topics, mainly big pet food companies. And so, because I had spent so much time working on that, doing all that research, I could recognize tactics, individual names. There are people whose stories pop up again in the FDA investigation. There's some language that's used that's very typical of what I'd come to think of as kind of scientific propaganda, as opposed to good faith efforts to try to use science to understand topics. And so all that stuff caught my attention.
It was so funny because we would get so many pet parents, right, calling us up, and they would say, my vet said my dog has dilated cardiomyopathy and they need grains. And we're like, you know, in a raw diet, you have enough taurine in there, right? And you've got it in the organs, you've got it in the heart, you've got it in the dark meat. And we were just like, this makes no sense. However, Dan, I don't know if you got this, but if you don't wear a white coat, the white coats, even with their misinformation, seem to have more weight when it comes to sometimes our pet parents than we do. And so I would see these poor pet parents and I would send them the information, but I would see them get back on these, prescription diets and Hills. And here's the thing. Let me just say for our listeners, I'll read you a little bit. So in this lawsuit, you are alleging that Hills and its co-conspirators manufactured the DCM controversy in order to get large numbers of dog owners to switch from these boutique brands to products made by Hills. And you state in here that prior to this whole DCM controversy, that Hills' annual revenues grew by about only 1%. But in the 5 years
since. 5 years. So in the 5 years leading up to the FDA's announcement, 2013 through 2018, collectively, the company's revenues grew by 1%. So it's as flat as you can possibly be. At the same time, though, it's not just flat, it's shrinking. At the same time, the overall U.S. pet food market grew by something north of 30%. So Hill's was hemorrhaging market share. And I think the reason, one of the key reasons why that was happening in the lead up to the FDA's investigation is something you've highlighted, is that in the era of the internet, their dissemination of knowledge occurs through like valid, good, sound knowledge, scientifically based or otherwise, is reaches people through different channels. And accordingly, the strategies that Hill's has been relying on since the 1980s to use its get its messages to individual pet owners through veterinarians had become kind of eroded, right? And so that whole messaging channel has kind of been, this is more theoretical at this stage than it is like source of very close documentation and study, but it's like that's kind of what's going on there. It's like they've been the number one brand of veterinarians for a really long time. Well, in 2013 through 2018, for some reason, they were not doing a good job of it. They were losing market share year over year over year. Suddenly, the FDA investigation into DCM begins. It catches your suspicion, my suspicion. It looks like nonsense for all manner of reasons. But the natural impact of an investigation into the kinds of products that the FDA was looking at is for people to flock to the other side of the you know, proverbial ledger, which is to say, go to Hill's products. And so that's exactly what we see. Hill's is a division of a public company, and so they have to publish their financial records. And so if you look at the 5 years since the investigation began, their revenues have almost doubled. So it's like as stark a turnaround as you can possibly imagine. You know, it's like you have this thing that you would think, the FDA investigation, that you would think would have this impact. And boy, did it. They like just going from dead flat. We've got a chart in our lawsuit that shows what it looks like in visual terms. And it's just very striking that, you know, is one of the best things the company, to say nothing of like how wrongful and unlawful and unfair it is from a purely capitalist profit, evil genius perspective. It was hugely successful. Like they, it's one of the most successful things that company has ever done as far as making money goes.
This is a practice that has come about when Colgate, okay, so Colgate knew, hey, how do we move our products? We go into the dentist and they sell our product. So let's do that in the dog food world, right? Let's go into the veterinary community. Now, vets, dentists, doctors, they seem like they get all their information from, you know, those reps, right? They don't have time to really study the science. So a narrative gets going and bada bing, bada boom, the sales just go up, right? It's crazy. It's great marketing, right? You get the right people to say the things, even if the things are wrong. And I think we saw that during COVID, right? So it's amazing to me. But Dan, here's the thing. You know, one of the things that we do this podcast for is to get people to start thinking in that manner. When you see, for instance, pharmaceuticals that are everywhere on the commercials, right? You're watching the NFL series, you're watching the hockey series, whatever you're watching, and every other commercial has to do with pharmaceuticals, right? And you've got the happy people dancing around while they're telling you that your left nut's going to fall off and your tongue's going to swell up if you take this product, right? And you're like, yay, let's take that product because that one thing is going to save me or alleviate whatever the problem is. So that's one of the reasons that we do this. But still, Dan, people fall for this every day. So I love it that you're bringing this lawsuit and you're bringing awareness. It was amazing to me because in your lawsuit, I want to ask you how you do this. First of all, through your freedom of information, you found out some pretty important stuff. And, you know, we kept seeing this Lisa, a veterinary, this vet, right? She kept putting out this information from Tufts. We're looking at this going, what the hell? Right? Our daughter's a vet, right? And so I know the whole vet industry and I know the whole how they work, how they're paid, how they're marketed to. But we were just like, where is the real scientific information? And it wasn't there.
So in order to try to gather more information about this, one of the things that I did like research on a variety kind of fronts. You know, I'd written a book, and so I know how to do a certain amount of like journalistic type stuff and scientific research, blah, blah, blah. But one of the most, like you keep saying, one of the unique things that I did that I don't think anybody else did in the country did, certainly not before me, and I'm not sure if anyone else had really ever even done it, is I reached out to the FDA and made what's called a Freedom of Information Act request. The Freedom of Information Act is a federal law. And what it says, in essence, is if a citizen of a government asks our government, asks the government for its records, the records that show what it's doing, unless it falls into an except, the specific records fall into an exception, the government kind of has to give them to you. And there are a lot of exceptions. So like, I can't ask the government for your social security number and your tax returns, all right? That's confidential for very valid reasons. I can't ask for national security stuff, which is like confidential for other important reasons. But generally, unless the records you're asking for fall into one of those valid exceptions, government kind of has the Freedom of Information Act says the government kind of has to give it to you. And since this particular controversy involved the FDA, I reached out to the FDA and I just said, like, here's my FOIA request. Give me the whole DCM file so I can figure out what's going on in this. And in news that will surprise none of your listeners, the FDA said, no, we're not doing that. We don't have to do that. And they tried to make an argument legally that would try to frame up why they said, we don't have to actually do that. The argument specifically, at the risk of going into the weeds too far, is they said, well, this is an ongoing investigation, which of course it is. And ongoing investigations are one of the categories of records that are exempt from FOIA disclosure. But what they're describing in that exemption is totally different from what's going on here. Usually what they're talking about in the ongoing investigations exemption is like ongoing criminal investigations. You know, if the I can't ask the FBI for any, if I murdered somebody and I learned the FBI is investigating me, I can't be like, give me your entire file on the investigation into me. It compromises the investigation. That's not the kind of investigation that's going on here, right? This is a scientific investigation where everyone is motivated by the same thing, try to get to the truth. And so I felt that way. And because I was a lawyer in a past life, I knew that when the government says no to you, the next step that you do is you sue them. And so I sued them and I won. And they started giving me the documents. And this would have been some point in 2019. And every 6 weeks, I started getting a new CD. The government would send me a physical CD through the mail with something between 500, 1,000 redacted PDFs on there that were just scans of the records that made up the DCM file. And there are a lot of records in that DCM file. So this went on for 3 years. I just get another CD every 6 weeks. And I do my best to like organize and think through and evaluate it and try to piece it together and everything else. And over the course of that happening, like it took about 3 years for them to say, all right, we've sent you everything you've asked for. And ultimately, what's contained in those documents is what I describe, I think very accurately in the lawsuit, smoking gun evidence of fraud, that there is clear evidence that the FDA's investigation was induced, was brought about by fraud committed by the people that are the defendants in the lawsuit. What I'm describing are the allegations contained in the lawsuit. And as we sit here and record this on April 25th, 2024, the lawsuit is still at a very early stage. And the other side, the bad guys, as I see the world, the defendants, haven't responded to the key substantive allegations yet. Our complaint, the document that begins a lawsuit, is really big. It's 125 pages long. They're going to need a lot of time to respond to everything. We gave them an extension of their initial deadline for filing that response. So we haven't seen it yet. So what we've got right now, and it's important everybody understands it as this, are like unrebutted allegations at this point. It's very early on. But what I'm going to describe is the evidence that I uncovered that supports the allegations made in the lawsuit, if that makes sense. Anyhow, What do I find? So when the FDA announced its investigation in 2018, it said that it gave a justification for why it was doing that. It didn't just do it completely out of the blue, unjustified. What they said is, we got a spike in DCM cases involving these kinds of foods, which sounds very reasonable. If indeed, like, the FDA has long had a reporting functionality on its web presence and in other places where, like, if you're a US citizen and you consume, or your dog consumes, some kind of food or drug product, and you think the animal or the person gets sick, or something bad happens as a result of it, you tell the FDA. They've got like a reporting portal set up for that, okay? And they do all sorts of things in light of that. And so what they said is, we got a spike through reporting mechanisms like that of dogs with DCM that are eating these specific kinds of diets. We don't know exactly if there's a thing yet, but that's why we're launching the investigation. They never told the public, though, where those reports came from, how many of them there were prior to the launch of the investigation. They just said there was a spike, and they didn't name who reported the cases. But when they sent me their DCM file, that is information that's contained in there. And so I was able to piece together how many cases made up this spike, where the cases came from, and if there was anything unique, misleading, inappropriate about them. And so here's what they show. Prior to the FDA's announcement of its investigation, it had received a grand total of 28 reports of canine dilated cardiomyopathy in the year 2018. Now, 28 cases is, it's a significant number in two ways. Number one, it's somewhat larger than the agency is used to receiving. It kind of, there's a document in the file that shows how many cases of DCM were reported to the FDA in the years leading up to 2018. And it's always like half a dozen or less. And so to see 28 cases in 2018 is a legitimately higher number, 4 or 5 times higher than what they're used to seeing. That is kind of a big difference. That's notable in that way. But it's notable in a second way too, which is that DCM is not a disease that only 3, 5, 6 dogs get a year in the United States. It's just that the FDA only receives reports saying, I think this had something to do with my dog's food, to the tune of 3 or 5 a year. The number of dogs that actually get DCM every year in the United States is something in the at least the hundreds of thousands. Okay. Regardless, prior to any of this DCM nonsense or any of this FDA investigation nonsense, there are publications out there, and they're actually, in one of the more interesting facts, I think, in the whole thing, there are publications put together by one of the defendants in the lawsuit, the same one you referred to, Dr. Lisa Freeman, contributed to this reference guide that was put out some 10 years before the investigation, where she's writing about cardiac diseases. She refers to dilated cardiomyopathy as the second most common cardiac disease that dogs get in the United States today. And she says that something like 10% of dogs in the United States get some form of cardiac disease. There are 70 million dogs in the United States. You got to assume that even by the most conservative estimates, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of animals getting this disease. So, and without regard to, like, this was, she's putting out this reference guide like before there were grain-free diets, okay? So this is like a very relatively widespread disease. So 28 cases is significant to both of those things, not a huge spike. Second thing that the cases show, it's one thing for the FDA to launch an investigation if it gets 28, if it's used to seeing 6 cases of DCM a year, and then 1 year it gets 28. And those 28 come to the FDA from a bunch of unrelated people from all around the country. That's a signal that something's up. Something is afoot there. That's a way bigger number than they're used to receiving. These people have no relationship with one another. They're all sending something at the same time. That's scary. I would want my public health agency looking into that. But when you look at the cases, that isn't what happened. What happened is that 3/4 of the cases that were in the spike that the FDA received came from 2 people. They're both now defendants in the lawsuit, Dr. Lisa Freeman and another woman named Dr. Darcy Aiden. was a professor. I always mix this up. She's changed over the course of the loss or over the course of the relevant facts from Florida to NC State. And I can't remember which way she went, but Dr. Freeman's at Tufts. The other Dr. Aiden's at one of these other schools. And it's not that a bunch of disparate pet owners sent in a bunch of records. Those two sent in 21 of the 28 cases. So that's kind of a suspicious fact, or that change.
Yes,
that's not
what reported to the
public. Well, hold on a second. I'm not at the kicker. Oh. That's like, to me, that's like, okay, we should have heard about that. The public should have heard that was the case, that we never got that information. We should have. It influences how we should understand it. But it's not fraud. What's fraud is how those cases were chosen, what cases those people reported to the FDA. Like I mentioned before, dilated cardiomyopathy is a common enough disease that you're able to find tens of thousands of dogs that are developing it every year, either on a grain-free diet, on a grain-containing diet. There are going to be some, even with no relationship whatsoever to diet, random chance, you're going to have tens of thousands of animals in each one of those buckets. If you go looking intentionally for dogs falling into one group or another, and let's say you just happen to be a veterinarian that works at a major clinical practice, a university veterinary hospital, you're going to find them. You're going to be able to, should you want to, cherry pick cases containing specific or involving certain kinds of diets. And there's evidence that got submitted to me in connection with the FOIA request that shows that cherry picking did in fact exist. In both cases, Dr. Freeman and Dr. Aiden. It's described in the complaint. You could see the email. Like in Dr. Freeman's case, there's an attachment to an email that she sent that it's like a throwaway document, kind of. It's like the kind of thing you could easily gloss over. That's got a, she admits that the protocol that her hospital was using in selecting cases that it would send to the FDA. She says it explicitly. If, and it not only explicitly, like with kind of the kind of language that is so typical of an industry affiliated veterinarian, she says, like, if the patient is being fed a reputable brand, with the implication being that's Hill's and maybe a couple of others, don't report the case. If it's being fed a boutique, exotic, or grain free diet, a term that she coined, then you report that case to the FDA. Okay, so that, people, is evidence of fraud. It's one thing if you report a unbiased sample of dogs with DCM to the FDA, and then you let the FDA sort out whether there are specific dietary qualities or anything else that show up in the data. If you intentionally cherry pick those cases and send those to the FDA, you are causing them to develop a false impression about what your data show. And that's exactly what happened here.
I think what bothers me, though, Dan, is that you asked for the FOIA mm-hmm. and they tried not to give it to you, right? Yeah. So I'm always suspicious about that. If you have nothing to hide, why are you hiding it?
Yeah. Look, there are valid reasons to not produce FOIA documents. In this case, the one that they tried to use was, in my judgment, facially inapplicable. Like, it was not... I'm not saying that they acted with bad faith, but it clearly was not a winner. And that's why, like, once I filed the lawsuit, they rolled over quite quickly. Like, it didn't take drawn out years of litigation like I expect this class action to take. It was relatively quick. And I think that's because they were kind of like, yeah, there's no way we're winning this. And so, yeah, that suggests that's not a great look. You know what I mean? Like, if that's the best you got, that's not a great look. But yeah, I don't have... It's like I went into it suspicious. I got a bunch of documents. The documents are evidence of some things and not evidence of other things. I followed it where the story like went, and the story shows that there's fraud. It's spelled out exactly in our long lawsuit. Like, this is something like a very detailed thing, and I tried to explain it as such. There's no part of the lawsuit that's like, here's what FDA did wrong specifically, because I don't really have that. I don't know at this point, at least, like as this goes forward, I'm sure your listeners will know, like when in the legal system in the US, when you file civil lawsuits, they go on long enough, you get into a phase that's called discovery. And discovery is like this aspect of any litigation where both sides get to like understand what facts the other and what evidence the other side has. So you get to do things like take depositions. So if you get far enough in this case, you would, our legal folks will have the ability to ask Lisa Freeman questions under oath, under penalty of perjury, about what took place. There are FDA officials who are in all likelihood relevant witnesses to the circumstances that are involved that are underpinning the case. In all likelihood, those people are going to get deposed. And those could reveal things that are that tell a particular story. But at this point, that hasn't taken place. And so you have like stuff that are in the documents, in the public record, or attributable to some other evidentiary source. And so it's just a little too quick, in my judgment, to try to say, like, this is what happened to the FDA. I don't think it's too quick to say, like, something here went wrong, you know? Like, somehow there's, you can't claim at this point, now that they've closed the investigation and said, yeah, there's no there. It's pretty inarguable that something went wrong. Exactly how it went, we don't know yet.
All right. So why or what did you find out in your Freedom of Information as to why Lisa Freeman and the other vet did this? Why? What was their motivation?
So this is primarily not based on evidence that came through the Freedom of Information Act. So the Freedom of Information Act provided some stuff that's very significant to this case, kind of the smoking gun of how these people committed this fraud on the FDA. It's not the sole source of evidence. And so, you know, it's not the case that Dr. Freeman was writing any emails that I'm aware of to the FDA saying, like, here's why I'm cherry picking these cases. Like, that's not, to my knowledge, that was never a subject of conversation there. So her motive for doing that comes from other evidence. Okay. And what that evidence is Dr. Freeman, like, part of her job is to be a research veterinarian. So not just like the kind of veterinarian that treats patients. She's primarily like an academic. She's a professor at Tufts University, and she conducts scientifically significant research, studies, writes papers, other academic things like that. And a lot of journals, because industry-funded scientific misinformation is so common in this day and age, a lot of journals have tried to combat that by requiring conflicts of interest disclosures out of the folks who publish, write articles that are going to get published in those journals. And so if you take all of Lisa Freeman's publications and sit them all down in a spreadsheet, you can see pretty well when she's disclosing conflicts, financial conflicts of interest with individual corporations. And so you can see that Hill's Pet Nutrition is a company that's been paying Lisa Freeman extensively for a long period of time. And so, as I mentioned before, the DCM investigation is incredibly good for Hill's Pet Nutrition, was clearly very good for them. The fact that Dr. Freeman engaged in a variety of things, not just lying to the FDA or misleading the FDA, but also a cluster of other forms of misconduct that are described in the lawsuit, while being paid by the beneficiary of that very scheme, is what's called circumstantial evidence of Dr. Freeman's motive to conduct the misconduct that she engaged in. Does that make sense? In essence, what happened is Hill's Pet Nutrition benefited from this. They paid Dr. Freeman, and therefore Dr. Freeman advanced the scheme. That's kind of like the very simple one-line explanation.
All right. So If Dr. Lisa Freeman at Tufts University wanted to mislead the FDA, you don't know what Lisa Freeman's thinking, but if you were Lisa Freeman and you were going to try to mislead the FDA, you're going to try to mislead the FDA so they do what? What would be your motivation, or what is the hope that someone has to mislead the FDA? What was she hoping that the FDA would do?
Here's a good way to answer that question. One thing that comes through when you sit down and read our lawsuit is that the DCM controversy is not a standalone plan scheme. It is a play run from a playbook that has been run before by all of relatively more or less the same exact individuals. Remember at the beginning of this, I referenced, like, Lisa Freeman's name is catching my eye. As an entrepreneur who runs a raw dog food company, will already be very aware of probably the second most prominent one of these kind of campaigns that Lisa Freeman engaged in, which is she is the primary academic who put out the papers in the early 2000s that tried to make the case to veterinarians primarily that raw dog foods are bad options for pets because, number one, there's a risk of contamination with foodborne pathogens that can make people sick. And number two, as they would misleadingly say, there's no evidence these things are better. Dr. Freeman herself is like the one who, in very similar way to what took place in the DCM matter, put out papers that helped form that belief in the veterinary community. Okay. And so what I think, let me take one step back. In that case, what was notable about raw diets, as the previous, as concerned the previous matter, is that that was a category of products that competed directly with Hill's. The people, you could either feed Hill's or you could feed raw, but you couldn't feed, the Hill's didn't make raw, okay? So by demonizing, for whatever kind of justification, a broad class of products, Dr. Freeman could take a competitor, a group of competitors out of the market for Hill's. It's a good thing for Hill's' bottom line. And what I allege in the complaint is that the intention all along in the DCM matter was roughly the same: to take a different, larger, more diverse group of products, what Dr. Freeman would come to call BEG pet foods, boutique exotic ingredient or grain-free pet foods. That's another group that is large, diverse, just like raw diets, but larger, more diverse, and most notably, is mutually exclusive to Hill's products. So like that's a group that has all, it has raw diets in it. It has cooked, kibble diets in it. It has all meat diets in it. It has zero meat vegan diets in it. It has homemade diets in it. It has diets made by $900 million a year brands in it. Very diverse. But for all the things that it contains, it contains nothing. It does not contain Hill's products. And so what it seems to me, the motivation, and this is what we allege in the complaint, the motivation here was to put a similar kind of demonizing label, cast a kind of shadow over that entire group of products within at least subsector of the pet food market. And so I don't know that they were looking, I don't know to what extent they wanted any specific thing from FDA, but I feel very confident that what they wanted was for the FDA to, in a public way, say, we're at least worried that all these products are doing this thing, causing DCM.
And that's really all you have to do. That's really all you have to do, Dan. As I was saying, you just have to give a little doubt, right? And pet parents go running and screaming, and the veterinarian industry will back that up. They've got the white coats and they say, absolutely. And we still hear it today, right? Oh, raw dog food, you got this. And it's so funny because I will always say, you know, how did you come to the link that some sort of raw dog food made your pet sick? What was the pathogen? What's the load? What's the variant? You know, all of it. And yeah, our daughter's a vet, so I can go straight to her and say, can you give me these numbers? And she said, no, we can't.
Yeah.
No, we can't. We can't give you those numbers. They're made up.
It's not even, well, I mean, we could go down this rabbit hole till I'm blue in the face. Like, the, again, it's evil, but it's evil, still evil genius. Like, they did a, you're still dealing with this issue 20 years later. So it's like they did what they were aiming to do well. It's unquestionable, like reasonably well, because they were able to, like, and one of the things they do really well is to use very specific language that in some cases might be literally true, but highly misleading, okay? So like, it is the, well, in my judgment, there's evidence to suggest that there is the possibility of foodborne pathogens in some raw meat products. There's nothing in the, even in the literature that Dr. Freeman ever tries to highlight suggesting that they make dogs sick. Like, her whole case was built around the idea that the downside to these products is, she highlighted kind of two things in her judgment, both of which don't hold water in mine. Number one, oh, there's potential nutritional adequacy. If you have people making the diet at home, they're not going to know. They're going to screw up the micronutrients, number one. Number two, there's this foodborne pathogens thing. But the quiet part, the part that like doesn't make it through to a lot of vets, is like, which is to say people might get sick. If you get feed a raw meat that is, God forbid, contaminated, and then you go pick up your dog's feces with your bare hands, you could get sick. But there's no evidence that a dog is getting sick from that. That's not something. And so, and even today, but like you can see through the game of telephone, how easily the message is really that she actually says becomes something more. And then people start seeing what they are primed to see.
If you are in a position,
I know,
being that pet health professional, then why
are you? It's a privilege, right? It's a privilege. People trust you. You've earned that. Like, I get it. When I say I'm sympathetic, it's like we're talking about a group of 100,000 people. The reality is that talking in generalities about the entire group is unfair to somebody. And, you know, it's like there's just people on both sides.
I get it. I get it. Bad ones.
But there is definitely, you know, there are some places where I go, Jesus, it must be so hard to have the information environment to which you're exposed in school. You did a really nice job of articulating it. Be so comprehensively dominated by these industry forces. It's, you have to step to, like, I don't know, try to get truth in it. You have to go so far outside. You can't just like push back on one study. It's like you have to go, who's the publisher of the book? Okay, what organization funded that? Okay, what corporation funded that organization? And it's like, it's too much. And I sympathize there. On the other hand, there are some specific things. And the one I have been saying on other shows that I say because it comes up in my professional life all the time, and it's absolutely jaw-dropping, is this one. Diabetes is a disease that, generally speaking, if you want to put it in colloquial terms, is you're allergic to carbohydrate. Your body can't do the things that it needs to do to process carbohydrate. It doesn't make enough insulin to make the glucose that comes from the carbohydrate go away. And so you get too much sugar in the blood. Okay. It's allergic to carbohydrate. That's what it is. Not surprisingly, in modern America, the standard of care for a dog with diabetes is to put the animal on a prescription product made by Hill's Pet Nutrition that is 40% digestible carbohydrate. It is like saying, your dog has a peanut allergy. All right, you should feed this 40% peanuts product to your dog. And it's like the justification used by Hill's as why this is what should be recommended to these dogs is that the product contains less carbohydrate than the other Hill's products, which are like 50% carbohydrate. And that little bit of difference means it is better than those. But if you take a dog and take all or almost all of the carbohydrate out of its diet, you have a much better outcome. Okay. Dog can't process carbohydrate. You have to, as a medical practitioner, have more confidence and competency than to say, this dog has this disease, is having successful management of this disease. I'm going to elevate the possibility of this propaganda thing above that and take a patient that's having good outcomes and tell it to stop doing the thing. That is mind-blowing for me. And so there's people in both buckets at the end of the day. And I have sympathy with some, not with others, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and to me, that's evil, Dan. That's the definition of evil. And I don't get it. I just don't get it. And when you see,
I mean, like if I was playing devil's advocate and I was trying to defend how this situation can exist and vets in good faith, smart people that are actively trying. I mean, I do believe that, like, people go into veterinary medicine because they want to help animals. That's why they do it. Of course. Right. And the vast majority of those people are pretty darn smart. It's not, you know, I don't know. It's anything else. It takes a long time. You got to earn these degrees. These are reasonably smart. These are people that are supposed to be scientifically literate. And yet you have this kind of thing happen where there are subjects that were clearly false information is the mainstream perspective on it, despite the fact of what the scientific evidence says. That's happening all the time in this community. How can that happen? Well, the only answer is because the kinds of companies that have created this, fostered this environment, are massive, well-resourced, been working at it directly for decades. They're good at it. It's hard. And it's like, In contrast with, like, you know, there are 100,000 vets in the United States ish. You know how many veterinary nutritionists there are? It's fewer than 100.
Oh, okay.
You can, like, that's not a challenge to just influence those 100, whether it's through money, through some kind of formal relationship.
Okay, gotcha.
That's something a $1 billion company, that's not ambitious. That's totally realistic for them to pull off.
Is Lisa Freeman does she still have a job in spite of everything that she's done? Because obviously in this country, supposedly you are innocent until proven guilty, but she's still out there.
Just to be clear, civil lawsuit, meaning we're saying these guys owe us money and need to do a variety of other things differently, but it's not a criminal one where there's guilt and innocence. But that being said, to the best of my knowledge, yeah, she is still a professor at Tufts. I wouldn't say, obviously that's not somebody with whom I have direct social contact. We're now on opposite sides of a lawsuit. I don't know exactly what's good, but to the best of my knowledge, yeah, she's still doing her thing.
So here's my thought, Dan. Any university that would continue to employ somebody that obviously has done things that are not on the up and up would taint my entire thought about that university and any information that they might put out.
Yeah, I mean, you probably aren't the only one. If I'm playing devil's advocate and I'm trying to defend Tufts University, I'd say something like, well, look, this is the beginning of a lawsuit. Yeah, there's evidence here. And yeah, it's pretty worrying. But if we fire this person, you can't unring that bell. So we got to see where this all goes. You probably say something like that, which feels pretty reasonable to me. You know, these are serious allegations. It's a big process involving legitimately independent parties, a federal court. So if I were them, I might say something like that. But I'd also, I don't think you'll be the only one who, it does happen in this day and age, and it's a fair outcome in a lot of instances when it happens, where evidence comes out that suggests some specific kind of misconduct. And even before there's some kind of formal trial, the evidence itself is all that people need to form their opinions about what took place. There's some things that are like, well, it doesn't matter what they say by way of response to this. The fact that they did all this is enough to make me go like, this is a mess. So you're entitled to that, but they're entitled to their defense too. It'll be interesting to see what they say.
Yeah. Well, I just last question, cause I know you got a hard stop and you got to go. Did in all this investigation that you did, was there any evidence that showed that Tufts University is sponsored by Hills on any of their programs, that they get sort of any kind of money that comes from Hills directly or indirectly?
So Tufts is a private university. Freedom of Information Act is a federal law about public agencies, right? I can ask the government. Government's got to give it to me. I can't just write you a letter and say, due to the Freedom of Information Act, give me all your medical records or something like that. So I'm not in a place yet in the litigation where I can say to Tufts, all right, give us all the records on anything pertaining to Hill's Pet Nutrition. Should the lawsuit go far enough, we will be able to do precisely that. So the information contained in the lawsuit about the nature of the financial relationship between Hill's on the one hand and Tufts University, its professors, its discrete like units within the broader university on the other, is generally from public information, cobbling together of public sources. But there is clearly a financial paper trail between not just Lisa Freeman, but other members of the, what do they call it? The Clinical Nutrition Service at the Tufts Cummings Veterinary School. There is, to give you just one example, one of the other defendants in the lawsuit is an organization called the Mark Morris Institute. Mark Morris, in a really bizarre fact, is the founder of Hills. Like Hills Pet Nutrition wasn't founded by Hills, a guy named Hill. It was founded by this guy, Mark Morris. And Mark Morris Sr., the Morris family is still one of the larger shareholders, sits on the board of directors, etc. Mark Morris Institute is named after that guy, okay? It's a nonprofit but every penny of its budget comes from nonprofits do have to make their records public. And so you can see where their money comes from. Every penny of its budget comes from Hill's Pet Nutrition. Okay. This, and so it's like, it is not an exaggeration at all to say it's an extension of Hill's Pet Nutrition. And there's somebody else that works on the clinical nutrition service at Tufts alongside Dr. Freeman that's very closely involved. I forget her, that's set forth in the lawsuit if people want to see it exactly, but she had an executive level position at Mark Morris for years and may still have it even. I'm not clear off the top of my head, but it's documented in the lawsuit.
Well, we so appreciate you coming on today because I couldn't read all 125 pages.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I did read a bunch of points to our listeners to call their attention to it. But good on you. Good on you. And hopefully some real wins will come out of this for you and for everyone involved. And so we'll bring you back and we're going to get an update. So
I've been saying that to other hosts of other kinds of shows that like one of the things about litigation in the United States is that it takes a really long time and it's going to take a long time in this case. Like we filed the suit in February. We haven't gotten their like first answer document, the first responsive document that they're required to file yet, even though it's months later. It's going to take a long period of time before the dust settles on it. But what that means is that they're going to be interesting, significant things that happen during the pendency of it. And that there, those will be worthy of discussion. And so I'd be happy to come back on and talk about updates, the latest in the litigation, when and if that that stuff comes about.
Yeah, I just think that the fact that you brought to attention that Lisa Freeman was the one who started the whole, oh my gosh, raw diets are bad for dogs and for, you know, and you explained that great. And now she's involved in this other thing. So it just brings, I think it just helps pet parents to step back, right? Yeah. When they are bullied, when they are told stuff, is to really investigate. We don't have to have like all of this research to look at my dog and say, no more allergies, no more itching. The poops look good. The gut's good. They have this vitality about them. That's pretty telling. So thanks for all you do, Dan, and thanks for coming on Raw Dog Food Truth today, and we'll get some more information out. You guys, thanks so much for listening to the Raw Dog Food Truth. Remember, you can get your dog on a species-appropriate diet. It's super easy. Just get over to rawdogfoodandcompany.com, where your pet's health is our business, and friends, don't let friends feed kibble. We'll see you soon, everybody. Bye-bye.
Oh, snap.
Find out how you can start your dog on the road to health and longevity. Go to rawdogfoodandcompany.com, where friends don't let friends feed kibble, and where your pet's health is our business.
Just snap.